Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to the Quarantine Break podcast. Today's guest is Robert Webb, perhaps best known for playing Jez in Peep Show as one half of Mitchell and Webb. But more recently, Robert has gained critical acclaim in the world of books. His 2017 memoir, How Not to Be a Boy, was an incredible and searing look at the construct of masculinity while simultaneously being deadly funny. Now his debut novel, Come Again, which Robert describes as griefy, is released at the end of this month and is utterly hilarious. We had a great chat over the course of half an hour, speaking about the book and writing, but, of course, Peep Show, and whether we'll soon be seeing a digital lockdown version, like Carshare, anytime soon. We talk about what he's been doing while staying indoors, and we chat about some of the celebrity videos we've seen and had some thoughts on. Take a listen, and I'll be back at the end. I can only begin one way. Are you feeling well? Are you feeling healthy?
I'm feeling both well and healthy, yes. No, we're all fine here, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Are you well? It used to be such a generic greeting, didn't it? I genuinely miss those days.
Yeah, and now it has this terrible weight behind it, like you're asking an actual question. Are you stricken with the terrible plague? No, I'm not yet stricken with the terrible plague. I feel fine. Well, for all we know, I may be without knowing. Oh, what fun times.
So the idea of this podcast is to take a little tea break from the world, which is needed, I think, at the moment.
Mm.
As it's a tea break, how do you take your tea? Any particular bag or blend?
Milk, no sugar. At the moment, for weird health reasons, I have to drink decaffeinated tea, but which actually I'm so used to now, it tastes like real tea. Although I'm pretty sure that in the first few days, I definitely noticed the difference. But now I'm not thinking about that too much now. It's, as far as I'm concerned, it's just tea. So yeah, I have a bit of milk in it, but no sugar. I heard a story, this may be misattributed to Ridley Scott, but if I'm libeling him, I don't think it's too bad because it's quite a nice story, which is that whenever he starts a new movie, he gets all the assistant directors and all of the runners to gather around, and he takes out a Dulux color chart and he points to one of the shades of brown and he says, "This is the color of tea. No other color is tea." So he shows them all how he wants his tea, which I admire, although he sounds like an absolute nightmare. Maybe I shouldn't spread this story around.
I mean, if you've got Russell Crowe on set and he's coming up with really weak brews.
The least you want is the right kind of tea.
Yeah.
If not the right kind of vodka.
So because of social distancing, we're obviously talking over video chat today. I mean, you might have noticed I'm not in the room with you.
You really aren't. I was kind of disappointed, but that's all right. It's, you know, at least it's hygienic. We feel, as far as I'm aware, we're all feeling safe. It's good.
I suppose in the old days, we're talking about 4 weeks ago.
It does feel like the before times, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Even now you're sort of watching TV of stuff that was obviously made before before the after times, and you're going, don't stand so close to it. Why are you hugging? What's going on? These people are crazy. Kissing? You must be joking.
I look at news presenters and I get genuinely anxious when they're sat too close together.
Yeah, yeah. They're not always maintaining the full Osmond. They're not always 2 meters apart, as far as I can tell.
The Osmond method has been really useful, actually. Whenever I've rarely gone for a run, I've always imagined Richard Osmond, which is a weird thing to do when you're running.
I go for a walk once a day, and some people, I mean, yeah, there are some very wide interpretations of what an Osmond actually is. I mean, some people, they all but lick you as you go by. And others, you know, they will do an elaborate Corona dodge right into the middle of the road, into oncoming traffic. And I salute those people. And I hope motorists are getting used to the idea that at any moment, someone might just walk out in front of them for their own good. This is to be anticipated.
But I suppose in the old days, we probably would have been doing this in some kind of mid-level hotel room. There would have been a bed awkwardly in the corner. We would have both been trying to ignore it while we were having this conversation.
Like in Planes, Trains and Automobiles, we'll just start talking about the game. You see the game last night? Oh, hell of a game.
But we're using video chat for everything at the moment. Work, socialising, even dating apps are getting in on it, which sounds quite grim.
The word Zoom, up to a fortnight ago, it just what that word meant to me was just a pleasant single by Fat Larry's band from the 80s. But now it's such a big part of my life. And also something called Slack.
Yes.
Which my kids are 8 and 10, and they sort of talk to their friends over Slack, which I just never heard of before. I mean, it turns out quite a lot of homeschooling is just IT support. these things are all new. But I thought I'm 47, for crying out loud. I thought I'd finished learning new things, or I was hoping that I'd finished learning new things. But no, apparently there's more learning new things to be done.
But is Zoom infiltrating your day-to-day life? Are you having drinks with friends over Zoom? A lot of my parent friends getting quite excited because for the first time on a Friday, they can sort of go out with their friends, both of them, have a drink.
But also they can claim to have lost connection at any moment without seeming rude. They can just go. I've got a group of friends, about 8 of us, about 4 couples. I suppose we had somebody made up a quiz. We had like a pub quiz, and that wasn't as ghastly as it sounds. It was quite good fun. I wouldn't want to do it every week. I mean, you talk about missing your friends and, oh, I never get to see my friends. And then, you know, within seconds of talking to your friends again, your friends are being as annoying as your friends always were.
And now it's every weekend.
Now, yeah, it's just now you've got to schedule it like it's an event. And no, it's nice. It's nice to do. I do love my friends and it's nice to talk to my friends. It was a good quiz. Thank you, Toby, for organising the quiz.
You did tweet the other day, I've yet to have a video conference call where I don't at some point think I could take my top off. Am I going to take my top off? No, I'm not going to take my top off. I am maintaining standards just.
You know what, Simon? It's not just you. It's I think it's because I've got used to so much video conferencing that I'm through the temptation to take my top off. But now that you mention it, who knows what's going to happen later?
I mean, I like the sense of jeopardy for this podcast already. At any point, yeah, there could be full frontal nudity.
Who knows? I mean, what could happen? I mean, there's no downside for me. I mean, what are the sanctions here? I'm in my own home, Simon. I'm in my own home. Why not?
I mean, I don't have a tagline for this podcast yet, but may contain nipples would get me a certain audience, I guess.
I've got pretty nice nipples, actually. I'm not going to think about it.
It's been a mad time for all of us. I'm not sure about you, but I still wake up screaming, remembering that Celebrity Imagine video.
It was so horrible. Oh, I need to get up and shake that off. It was really fucking great. They all looked like they'd fuck up their meds. I mean, not a single one of them didn't look like there was something really unexpected and wrong going on in there with them cognitive dealings.
Why was it so slow as well?
So slow, and they and all in different keys, and all the kind of shrugging, modest, kind of self-deprecating, oh, this isn't so great. But there again, there are other people who clearly thought they could sing and they can't sing. And it was just so memorable.
And yet I watched the cast of Hamilton sing to a child and I was in floods of tears, which proves that there is no standards.
Yeah, it shows what we know. I mean, yeah. It didn't make me want to go and see Hamilton, I must say. I've been going around thinking, oh no, typical me, I should have seen Hamilton. I can't believe I missed Hamilton. Everyone talks about Hamilton. I bet Hamilton's great. And I watched that with that albeit very heartlifting and marvellous thing for that cast to do. And I thought, nah, I'm not that bothered about Hamilton. Maybe I should do more research about what I'm missing with Hamilton. But I just thought, Hamilton. Shut up, Hamilton.
For a sense of balance, Hamilton isn't like that on stage. Really? They don't appear on different screens.
Oh, okay. If they don't appear on different screens, then maybe they know what they're doing. I was trying to imagine it in the theatre. I thought this just wouldn't work in the theatre.
But how have you been keeping? What has been your biggest challenge so far during the lockdown? Or have you had any challenges?
You do feel a bit stressed and anxious and knackered and upset about, you know, it in general. And you feel sorry for the people who are, you know, having a much worse time of it. I can't help thinking there is no time during my life where this wouldn't have been worse. If I, you know, when I was a teenager and living with my dad, or when I was in my early 20s and living with a couple of mates, but we didn't have any money and it was kind of awful. And, you know, there are various parts of my life where it would have been a lot, lot worse to be stuck inside. As it is, I've got my three favourite people, who is my wife and my two daughters, and that's fine. We've got a tiny North London garden, but at least we can get outside and there's that. And there isn't that much to worry about in terms of I can work or I can not work, and I've been very lucky like that. So I'm just really grateful in a smug and overly sincere and desperately earnest way. I'm counting my blessings, but it's a stressful time for everyone, but we're all right, thank you for asking, is my answer. What's been the difficult bit? It's just the homeschooling really plays it out of you. I'm not a flipping teacher. I went to enormous trouble not to be a teacher. I think that would have been my default, you know, without knowing anything about it. I thought I probably would be quite a good teacher, and I'm glad that I didn't have to find out, because I'm pretty sure I would not have been a good teacher. I would have been popular but chaotic and kind of idle and bad, and I'd have been sued by now.
I mean, on school homeschooling, are you the sort of person who's up every day for PE with Joe, school classes with Connie Huck? Are you dancing with OT Mabuse, Rob?
Not that that last one sounds like the most fun, and I haven't done that. I'm going to check that out. Dancing with whom? Who should I be dancing with?
OT Mabuse.
Oh, cool.
From Strictly.
No, I like the sound of that. I did do Joe a couple of times, and I thought I would stop. but we did do that as a family while school was still going. So I mean, it's another world we're in, because we're in the Easter holidays, and next week it'll all kick off again. So yeah, I mean, God knows.
I mean, I suppose after Let's Dance for Comic Relief, there's surely been public demand for your own how-to dance video series.
You'd think, but no, the call hasn't come yet. I've got that leotard. I've got it out. I've had it washed and ironed. It's ready. it nearly fits. And I don't have the wig. I think it was the wig that really made it. But no, no one's asked, Simon. No one's asked.
I mean, there is so much being created digitally at the moment. Are you someone that looks at all of that and thinks, I want to do something? I mean, you have just finished a novel, so it's not like you've been sat around eating Frosties.
I'm sort of feeling a bit, I'm not feeling very sort of extrovert at the moment. I don't feel very sort of showy-offy, but maybe that will change, and I'll want to, you know, do my job, which I suppose is to entertain people. I've always said I would be doing that even if nobody paid me. But it turns out, no, actually, I've got nothing else to do. And yet I'm still not entertaining the country. It's outrageous, really. I mean, I have been weirdly busy with the book. I'm sort of writing bits and bobs, and I'm, you know, so I mean, I've been strangely occupied, but when the boredom really sets in, maybe then I will try to amuse everyone via video link.
I mean, I was thinking about this interview the other day, which I should say is the bare minimum an interviewer should do. It's a really low bar.
I feel ravished by your consideration.
Peep Show feels right for a digital comeback, surely.
A comeback. Well, that would involve me and David wanting to do it. What we always said was, when we finished on series 9, was that it wasn't the, you know, you'll notice we didn't drive a bus off a cliff at the end. I mean, they are still around, those characters. And we thought that what would be fun, if we are so blessed, is if David and I make it into our like late 60s, early 70s, it would be funny to go back and see Mark and Jeremy in the same flat, having the same conversations with the same theme music. Everything's exactly the same, except now they're about 72. That's what we sort of said. But I think in its present form, there's no call for. Well, anyway, what can I tell you? It got cancelled. There's no more Peep Show. Stop asking for more Peep Show. There is no more Peep Show. But we made loads. I mean, absolutely loads.
I mean, what is Jesse Armstrong up to these days? He sort of disappeared, vanished.
Disappeared, didn't he? Yeah, no, he stopped. I think he clawed his way to some kind of respectability on the back of Sam Bain's talent. And now he just, he looks through bins now, I think. I think he mainly looks through bins. Yes, it hasn't been such a dry patch for Jesse Armstrong, or indeed for Olivia Colman. So you know, it's been a great show for other people.
I was reading an article on Vulture speaking to writers on shows on how they would have treated an episode on coronavirus. So Michael Hsu was talking about Parks and Rec. There was one on Frasier, Curb Your Enthusiasm. I think they even talked about Lost, which was a little strange because wasn't it on an island? Isn't that the definition of self-isolation?
Yeah, was Lost knowingly a funny show?
Possibly towards the end.
Right. I mean, most sitcom is about lockdown anyway, sorry, that was a Ponzi thing to say. But I mean, metaphorically, it's like, you know, it's the characters in most sitcoms are there because they're stuck with each other. And Mark and Jeremy certainly are. They're sort of economically dependent on each other. And also, you know, they rely on each other because they sort of go, well, at least I'm not him. And that's the best thing about their lives, is that Jeremy can think, at least I'm not Mark. Mark can think, at least I'm not Jeremy. And I think they depend on each other like that. I mean, I think all sitcom is about characters being stuck together. So having made that tart little point, what was the actual question?
Well, I suppose, how would Peep Show have tackled a coronavirus episode?
There sort of was, wasn't there? There was an ep where they were in the nether zone, which was a bit in between the flat door and the front door. And I think, did they spend the whole episode there? Not quite, but it was quite a long one with just Mark and Jeremy talking to each other. So, I mean, they just did their usual thing, didn't they? It would be a lockdown episode of Peep Show would be a pretty typical episode of Peep Show.
But I would love to see it, Mark doing fraught Zoom calls with Johnson, Jeremy going to a club night on Twitch. Sam, Jesse, I'm sure you are listening. That story treatment is going relatively cheaply. Relatively.
Good. Well, I can't comment. I'm just a bystander to this transaction now. I'm just watching that happen in front of my eyes.
Lots of people have obviously been watching Peep Show for comfort during the past few weeks. Why do you think a show where its main characters killed and barbecued a dog, pissed in a church, tried to plant a gun on someone, has brought people such comfort in these times?
I don't know. I think it's my theory about what Peep Show is about is based on, in the first series, there's a bit where Jeremy makes friends with Jeff. And he's kind of going, oh, Jeff's a proper man. Jeff's proper. Jeff's into FHM and he plays pool and he shags birds and he's a proper dude. And Mark falls out with Jeff, of course. And Jeff comes around to the flat and Mark tries to broom him. He gives him the broom through the letterbox. He goes, I'm brooming you, Jeff. I'm brooming you. I'm giving you the broom. And there's this sort of panicked voiceover from Jeremy. It's going, Mark or Jeff, Mark or Jeff. Jeff's mainstream. And I could leave this weird, it wouldn't just be me and Mark anymore sitting in our weird little puddle. I could join the mainstream. And I think that's a lot of the feeling of the show is that it's about people who feel that they're in a weird little puddle and that everyone else is doing it properly. You hear more than once the line, it's like I'm having a good time. It's like I'm having, I mean, it's just so tragic, but I think that's a completely universal feeling that you're sort of self-consciously going, this is what it's like to have a good time. This is what other people having a good time is like. I am doing that for once. And it's a heartbreaking thing, but I think it's totally universal that we all feel from time to time, at least, that, you know, there's this cosmic party syndrome that you walk through a door and the party that's been going on stops. And everybody pretends to be normal because you're there now. And then as soon as you leave, the party can start again. I think that's, everyone feels that. And that Peep Show has that running through it like a stick of rock.
I was going to say, actually, another show that people keep referencing and re-watching at the moment is the event sketch from that Mitchell and Webb look. This apocalyptic aftermath, stay indoors flashing up on the screen. Where did that idea come from? And are you a time traveling wizard?
I am not a time traveling wizard, I can reveal. It came from the strange rhythms in the head of who wrote the first ones? I think it was David Mitchell and the writer Jonathan Dryden Taylor. John was one of the core sort of other writers on the sketch show. And then Jason Hazley and Joel Morris wrote another three of those. So I think they did three each of those two writing pairs. I had nothing to do with it. I didn't really like them. I wasn't one of the writers on those sketches, but it's horribly appropriate, isn't it? But I prefer to think of the more joyful in a rude way, working from home sketch, which is also found currency because it's about wanking.
Which nobody does, of course. They do their 9 to 5, then they wait for their partners to come from a separate room, and then they have dinner.
That's right. That's how it should be. That's the normal way.
Because I assume you probably don't watch shows starring yourself to bring you comfort. Or maybe you do. I don't judge.
It's been known. Not lately, but, you know, I'm a fan of Peep Show. I'm perfectly happy to watch Peep Show. If you want to imagine me sitting at home watching Peep Show, that's not inaccurate. I don't do it often. But it's been done. I mean, I go down, you can get sucked down those YouTube, you know, wormholes. And do I mean wormhole or rabbit hole? Rabbit warren. Those worm warrens. And I can start watching clips of Peep Show or indeed sketches from that Mitchell and Webb look. Perfectly happy to blow half an hour doing that.
But what TV have you been watching in the past few weeks?
Oh, other TV. I've been catching up with Curb Your Enthusiasm, which makes me laugh. A lot. I hadn't seen it for, well, about 7 series. I saw the first 2 or 3 seasons, and then I've only just noticed it's back. And he's got divorced. It all seems different. He's even pettier and meaner than he was before. I just love how instantly these very rude and unpleasant characters start shouting at each other about these minor slights or failures of social etiquette. I really enjoy it. It makes me really, really laugh very quickly when I start watching that show.
It's amazing because he doesn't have any of the redeeming qualities that a Mark or a Jeremy have. I mean, they're both awful people as well, but
they really
you
are,
do feel for them.
No, the challenge of the show was always to fight, especially with Jeremy. Well, because I was playing Jeremy, I didn't care about David's problems. the challenge of playing Jeremy was always to, you know, to find those vulnerable moments, all those poppyish, enthusiastic moments and play those because the rest of the time he is just this mean, petulant, sarcastic, talentless, deluded, stupid, spiteful and selfish person. So, you know, on paper, he's an absolute shit, But so it was always, the challenge was to make him watchable. By the way, that's not a criticism of Sam and Jesse. I mean, all of those things make him funny. It's almost all that stuff that makes him funny. Nice characters are not funny. Not very often anyway. It's harder. It was a question of making him bearable to spend half an hour with.
Have you been finding that you've been watching more TV in the past few weeks, or have you been finding other stuff to keep you busy? Mindful apps, baking. Everyone seems to be baking. Everyone has a sourdough on the go.
No, I don't have any real hobbies. my life's a sort of empty husk, really. I've been doing bits of work, bits of writing. I go for my walk every day. I've finally committed to Spotify Premium. You know, this is quite big news in my world. TV. The girls who are 8 and 10 have spent many years lobbying for a Nintendo Switch, and we finally gave in. Took pity on our locked down offspring, and so I've been playing a bit of Mario Kart.
Oh, it's wonderful, isn't it?
It's great.
Such a beautiful game.
I mean, some of those tracks, I mean, quite literally take my breath away. I kind of go, you career off the edge of a thing and your little parachute opens and then you go, where's the rest of the... Oh, it's there. I get quite involved.
I mean, yeah, the tracks in Mario Kart are beautiful. They're stunning.
I mean, I had a PS2 when I was about 30, which is longer ago than I care to mention. But apart from that, you know, I hadn't really... been really, really playing video games since I was a kid with my ZX Spectrum. So as you can imagine, the speed and quality of graphics has really come on quite considerably. I have to say. So to my 20th century brain, this is indistinguishable from magic.
What about reading? Have you been doing much reading during this time?
I'm an even more idle and chaotic reader than usual. I've got about at least 8 books open by my bed at the moment. There's a book about writing called First You Write a Sentence by, I can't remember his name, but that's quite interesting in its own way. I've started a massive Stephen King novel. I've also started the first volume of À la recherche de temps perdu in an English translation, just because, oh well, it's the most famous book I've never opened, so I thought I ought to open it. And it's quite tough, but it's quite immersive, really. You get from one end of a sentence to half a page down the other end of the sentence. You kind of go, well, at least I wasn't worrying about coronavirus. I was concentrating on not forgetting how this started. So there's that, but also fun books as well. Wishful Drinking by Carrie Fisher, I just finished, and that is a massive hoot. It's based on her stage show that she did in 2009 or something like that, and you can tell because every line is a joke or a setup for a joke, and it's just really very well honed. It's a very slight, very slim book, really easy peasy. I enjoyed that. So quite a few bits and bobs.
I'm basically a cliche in starting a podcast and all of this, because next to PPE and testing, a podcast is obviously the best thing to heal the world.
Yes, I agree. You can't go wrong with a podcast.
But does part of you think, fuck, I could have written this novel now? Now is the perfect time to write a novel. Why did I do it when I could still go to restaurants?
I suppose so, but it just didn't work like that. And also, I'm not sure if these are perfect circumstances to write a novel, really, because you need to be able to get out and talk to people and kind of unwind, and I'm glad. I mean, yeah, I'm very glad it's I'm very glad it's finished, and I will start the next one when I have an idea, but that doesn't seem to be happening right at this very moment.
I suppose a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, are going to be writing seriously for the first time over the next few weeks. This is obviously your second book after the wonderful How Not to Be a Boy. Do you have any advice for first-time writers?
It's odd, really, because I know what I ought to say, but the kind of advice that I was getting that sounded sensible was absolutely no bloody use at all, which was every now and again, there would be this kind of howl of anguish that I would let out on Twitter with the first draft of this novel. The memoir came much more easily. And partly because I planned it all. I gave myself a massive head start, and I'd written the first two chapters, and I'd written 50 pages about what happens in the rest of the book before any publishers saw it. Mm. So they could see that I vaguely looked like I knew what I was doing, or at least, you know, had made a good impression of looking like I thought I knew what I was doing. Anyway, whereas this was just, it was half a page. It was like three paragraphs, you know, widow goes back in time, meets future dead husband when he's an annoying teenager. And that's basically the premise. And everything else was, I kind of got to that and I kind of went, okay, well, that's an idea for the beginning of a story. And then you have to go, okay, well, how would I like this to end? And I gather it would be quite useful to know if something interesting happens in the middle. And then I think you have to join everything up. So I was kind of going, oh, I don't know what to put. And then, sorry, to get back to your question, what advice would I give? The advice was always, just write it. Everyone, both writers and non-writers on Twitter, just write it. It doesn't have to be good. It just has to be done. It's first draft. Doesn't matter if it's crap. Just write it. And I'm going, fucking write what? I don't know what to write. That's the problem. I'm literally some kid in a classroom putting his hand up and going, teacher, I don't know what to put. So stop telling me, just put it. What do you mean? Just fuck off. So thank you for everyone for their encouragement. But yeah, what you do is you just write it.
I mean, this question feels more pertinent now, but why did you want to write a novel? It doesn't sound like a fun experience.
What is a novel? I mean, much as I love being associated very closely with Peep Show, and I'm very happy that people confuse me with Jeremy, and that I try to take that as a compliment as an actor, that I've convinced them that I am this person. But, you know, I am aware that every time I mention that I've written a novel, there is a certain number of people are going to get back to me with a line from Peep Show about how Jeremy doesn't know what a novel is, what is reading, how do you read, what is a book, all references to Mr. Nice. So that just comes with the territory, and that's fine. And I'm delighted that everyone is having their fun with quoting Peep Show. That's nice. What's the question? Why did I write a novel? Oh, because I had an idea for one, and I thought it would be a good way to entertain people. Because it's a funny book, it's an enjoyable book, even though it's a bit griefy, it's there to be hugely enjoyable. That's what its purpose is. So it's just another way of doing my job. So it seemed like a good idea at the time.
And how long had you been sat on this idea?
Since 2012.
Wow.
I know exactly where I was when I had the idea, because it was during the Olympics and we were filming Peep Show, and I was sitting in Jeremy's car. It's never been fully explained how Jeremy can afford to tax and insure a Volkswagen Golf, but he can. And we were waiting for the lights to be re-rigged, and I was on Twitter and somebody said, has anyone got any great ideas for a story? And I just remember looking through the window of the car, and Kate Marsden sort of came to me there. I don't know how that happened or how it will ever happen again. Maybe it won't, but that was the idea. And then I was busy as an actor, and the idea for the memoir, you know, doing a masculinity themed memoir, kind of overtook it, and it seemed more urgent. And that became the book that I wanted to do first, and also to get the memoir out of the way, so that you're not, your first novel isn't this thinly disguised thing about people you know. So I've done that, and now I can make up characters that I don't have to be tactful about.
So this is a period story because it jumps back to 1992, and 1992 is basically Regency drama now.
It really is. Yes. Oh, madam, I see you are wearing your Ned's Atomic Dustbin t-shirt that you borrowed from your boyfriend again. Yes, Mr. Darcy. It is a bit. I mean, 1992 was, so she goes back to, she wakes up and she finds herself in the wrong room, in the wrong body. She's 18 years old, but she remembers everything. And this is Freshers' Week at the University of York. This is where she met her husband Luke for the first time, who is in the future where she's just come from, recently dead. So she's going to meet Luke again. And I picked 1992 by, it was no accident, because that's when my Freshers' Week was. I am that old. And so I didn't have to do any detailed research about the times and the clothes and all of the, I don't know why I'm talking like the detail, because I'm thinking of detailed files that Arnold Schwarzenegger has in that movie where he is a robot. Anyway, I didn't have to look too many things up because I, you know, when your first week at college, if you have one, is quite a memorable time. So, so I remembered most of the stuff about music and clothes and bits and bobs like that. So, I find 1992 sort of interesting time generally because it was a sort of golden era of total boredom. I mean, there'd been a recession, which was very painful to some people, but other than that, we were kind of 2 years into John Major with another five to go. I mean, think of the 90s as that sort of New Labour Britpop kind of era, but that was really quite late. It was yet another conservative decade mainly, and it was tremendously dull. And I think one has a enormous nostalgia for dullness now.
I think it deals with time travel in a really unique way, because for most people, when they think about going back to their youth, they want to do something differently, date someone else, invent the iPhone, warn people about Nigel Farage or whatever. But for Kate, she wants to do it exactly the same.
Yes, she thinks that the reason that she's there is to warn Luke. And in order to do that, to convince him that she is his future wife and that he has a slow-growing meningioma in his head already, that he has a brain tumour that's going to kill him in 28 years' time, she has to win his trust. And the way she thinks she's going to do that is to do everything exactly the same. Hence comedy, because you can't do everything exactly the same. I mean, it's that daydream of going back and what you would do differently and what you would do the same. And I think that's universal. I think a lot of people have that daydream. I think it's peculiar. It would be weird if you didn't at some point. But I think you don't have to think about it for long before you realize it would be an absolute nightmare, because you'd be totally isolated. If you knew everything about, you know, your friend's future, your own future, the future world events, and you were the only person who knew this stuff, you'd be tremendously lonely. And also, you know, she's there with her future husband, but he doesn't know who she is. They've never met as far as he's concerned. He's just this girl. So it's quite griefy, really. There's a lot of, you know, it's about how, you know, she's stuck in the past because she lost her husband, and everywhere she turns, he's there, and she's not getting better. And she has to actually go and live in the past in order to re-engage with the present and to rediscover that the present has something to say for it. It's the bit where you move out of grief into mourning, where you start to reintegrate the lost past with the new present. And that's when we get better.
There's a really nice thread as well of meeting people when they're not quite done yet. I mean, Luke is probably sadly quite like the English student I was, you know.
He's certainly like the English student. I mean, I wasn't quite as bad as Luke, but I certainly pretended to have read books that I hadn't read. I never quite got to the stage of pretending to be French, which Luke pretends that he's related to Eleanor of Aquitaine. But, you know, she has to go through that. She's kind of sighing her way through this, all of these ridiculous affectations that he'd grown out of, or that she'd taken the piss out of him out of. And he is still this, you know, this boy. I thought that was an enjoyable part of it to write.
The book is such a huge amount of fun, and it's really, really welcome at the moment. It has that sense of a romp to it. Kate is a black belt who can kick the shit out of people. There's a car chase.
Yeah, why not? It gets pretty broad in places, and fuck it. She's a brilliant driver. She's got a phenomenal memory. She's a world-class computer expert, and she's a black belt in karate. So it's going to be a fun ending, clearly.
You're a busy man. How did you get the writing done? Are you someone that needs the perfect conditions to write, or can you be sat on a trailer bashing out 600 words over lunch?
It was always at home. I don't write anywhere else, but it was either here in the room that I laughingly call my study, or it was either downstairs on an outside table. I don't have it. I love those kind of Sunday supplement, where how I write columns, you know, where people go, I rise at 5:30 in the morning and I have some quinoa and do some yoga for an hour and then I blah, blah. And no, I'm slightly better in the morning. But if I do it in the afternoon, it's just as good. I like that. I was impressed by the thing that Philip Pullman said about the muse, that the muse won't always call, but you have to be in. You have to be at your desk in case it or she does. So that's, again, that sounds like terrific advice, which I would probably not follow myself. I mean, I'm just, yeah, I don't know how it got done. Slowly. if you ask the publisher with several deadlines missed, is how it got written.
Come Again feels very ripe for the screen. Is there any appetite to turn this into a screenplay?
I would love that to happen. There's talk. I won't disguise the fact that there is talk. There's talk. But I can't go further than saying there's talk.
Robert, thank you so much today for joining me. Thank you for taking the time out.
Thank you very much, Simon, and I wish you well.
That was episode 1 of the Quarantine Break podcast. A huge thank you to Rob, not only for spending half an hour of his time in all this madness, but for agreeing to do a brand new podcast. Robert, thank you so much for being the perfect first guest. Come Again is published April 23rd, but is available to pre-order now through independent bookshops, Waterstones, and Amazon. I really hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please like, subscribe, and as it's Easter, in lieu of chocolate, why not give me 5 stars? Don't forget to follow the Quarantine Break podcast on Twitter and Instagram at Quarantine Break. I'll be back with another episode soon, but in the meantime, please stay indoors.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.